The topic today is a century of planting trees, musing on 100 years of science at the Lethbridge Research Center with the speaker, Dr. Henry Jansen, who's a senior research scientist at the station with research focusing on how farming affects the permanence of farmlands and adjacent environments. And in recent years, he served on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and the group that he has worked on is looking at ways to reduce emissions, and that report is expected later this spring to summer. And without further ado then, I'll ask Dr. Henry Jansen to come forward and make his presentation.
Thank you, Henning, for that kind introduction. And I thank all of you for your kind attentiveness, at least for a while. Well, as you know, the Research Center celebrated its centennial this past summer. Thank you. And in preparing for that celebration, I was rummaging about in the archives and came upon these treasures, these old notebooks and journals from days of yesteryear. And they're treasures because they tell us more than sterile facts and data. They tell us stories and show us the people behind the stories. And the thing that astonished me in reading these old books, these old diaries, is the urgency, the emphasis given to planting trees. Over and over, we see notes like this. Miles and Wiles planted cottonwood. Charlie planted trees. Avens and Roberts planted ash trees all day. We read of 5,600 trees being taken from the river bottom, and not surprisingly thereafter, they spent some time in planting trees. And so when Superintendent Fairfield submitted his first report, he did not have much to say about spring crop sown, but he enthused about the apple trees set out and rhapsodized about the fine collection of trees and shrubs, 284 varieties in all. And still, to this day, we are planting trees. And so I ask the question to myself, why this devotion to trees? Why the allure? What so about trees fascinates us? Why do we plant trees? For aesthetics? Certainly, for we admire their form. Is a windbreak? Indeed. Heaven knows we need all the breaks from wind we can muster in this land. But I think there is another reason, a deeper reason, more subtle, visceral. I think we plant trees because they outlive us. They outlast us. They connect us across time. We sit in the shade of trees planted by those long gone, and the trees we plant today will one day be canopy for those we will never see. Trees are our proxies, our stand-ins in a world beyond our time. They are our living legacy. And in that way, I propose they are a lot like the research work that we do. And so that is the metaphor I want to contemplate very briefly with your kind indulgence this afternoon. A century of planting trees as metaphor. And I merely want to present some meandering contemplations on this metaphor, making some glimpses into the century past, and then from this vantage, peering ahead into the century that is coming. For as the poet says, we owe the future the past, the long knowledge that has come, the potency of time, the long knowledge that is the potency of time to come. And I think we do this best together, because this peering ahead is not for science alone. It is a community venture. So then a century of planting trees, a metaphor. A first observation, planting trees is risky. Tenderly we place these fragile twiglets into the cold earth, hoping for growth, but knowing the results, the outcome is unpredictable, I'm assured. The gardeners of old took careful notes of their trees' performance, and over again, we see these curt words, died, died, dead. And so it is also with our hypotheses, our brilliant ideas that we plant gingerly but with hope. Some of them grow and thrive and become magnificent specimens for all to admire. Others struggle to survive. And still others green for a time and then senesce and succumb, decaying eventually even from our memories. And so as we look back over the 100 years, we can enumerate a long string of successes. We can talk about new varieties of barley, of wheat, of forages, and crops of all hue and description. We can talk about new ways of tilling the land and new ways of not tilling it, so that we have now tamed the wind that once ravaged the land. And we have new ways of controlling pests such as diseases and weeds and insect pests of crops and of cows. We have new ways to raise our livestock. And just how far we've come is seen in some of these old notations. In 1909, someone wrote, made smudge of old boots and made calf breathe smoke of same for influenza. And the result of all this has resulted in phenomenal increases in productivity as seen in average daily rates of gain in studies 90 years apart. We could go on and on, an endless string of successes. But we don't want to forget the failures. So many of our brilliant insights have withered and decayed and faded from our memories. Whatever happened to the dreams of apple orchards? What happened to the noble idea of the cattle, a cross between bison and beef? And here's one that failed, only to be resurrected. It seems in 1908, they tried direct seeding, essentially no tillage. It flopped. It failed to emerge only briefly again as a breakthrough. From that rotten stump emerged new greenery, thriving, flourishing. Someone has said that 98% of research effort is not going to produce anything. The trouble is we don't know which 98%. And so we want to applaud all our successes. But I think we want to remember and cherish also the failures. For research is not like a factory. What counts is not just what comes out the end, but what we learn along the way. And I dare say that a magnificent, extravagant failure is often more illuminating than a safe and timid success. The question then for our next century is this: will we be bold enough even to fail? And planting trees transforms the landscape. And there may be no better example of that than the grounds of the research center itself, seen here. This is how it looked in 1908. A house standing alone on the endless prairie, unobstructed to the distant horizons. Here it is in 1915, 16, 17, 18, 20, and in the verdant forest at 1936, and as it is today. That's how planting trees is. You plant a sapling, and not much changes. Plant another one, still the results are not very noticeable. And then one day, you awake and look around, and the world's transformed. And so it is with research, too. Do an experiment, not much is gained. Do another study, the results are barely incremental. And then one day, you look around, and the world's a very different place. You can give all kinds of examples of that. Perhaps foremost is that of Fairfield himself, who even before he started the research center, imported 2 pounds of soil from an alfalfa field in Wyoming. And using that as an inoculum, he eventually sent sackfuls of the soil all around the country, resulting in phenomenal yield responses. And so the alfalfa production industry thrived and flourished. And they began to wonder, what do we do with all of the surplus feed? Maybe we should raise more cattle. And so a livestock industry was born, starting small, little hamlets of beef that eventually coalesced and grew to great, vast bovine metropoli that now dominate areas of the landscape. And the way the land looks has changed. Once we pulverized the land and kept it black, now we try to scratch it hardly at all. And so where once the air billowed with dust, now the air stays clear. And the land and the soil stays settled. And where once we were a breadbasket, now more a cornucopia. And we should not forget that the influence of a landscape extends far beyond the fences of the farmer's fields. This is an excerpt from Fairfield's diary in June 1910. Talking about thousands of trees, elm and ash and cotton, were destined for streets and parks, transforming the region as it is to this day. And so the work of the research community extends far beyond lab and fields, into history, into archaeology, to music, to charity, to culture, to languages, to science fairs and education. And so when we think of the landscape transformed, we want to remember also the value of young minds set aflame, of new words to speak, old thoughts, of communities enlivened, enriched, and enlightened. And then comes the question, what do we want the landscape to look like in coming generations? We ask many things of our farmlands. They provide us with food, with fiber, increasingly with fuel. They're a source of livelihood. They provide us with habitat for us and the creatures that we love. They filter our air, they filter our water. They rejuvenate our minds and lift our spirits. All these things they do for us. What do we want our landscapes to look like? And how do we make them look that way? And where do we even ask these questions? Where do we ask them together? Because these are not questions for science alone. A third observation. Planting trees requires long-term thinking and patience. A sprout becomes a tree only over time. Time made thee what thou wast. King of the woods, says William Calvert. And so a breeder makes a cross, envisioning a new variety years in the future, in a world not yet come. And new livestock breeds are developed, not in a season or two, but over long and patient time and generations. Perhaps my favorite example of long-term thinking are these, the historical dryland plots, a remnant of which still remain. I'm convinced, looking back at the old notes, that they were deliberately established with a long-term in mind, for they wrote of future generations, and they wrote of looking at them carefully over long periods of years, and so they took very careful notes, and they kept back soil even from as early as 1910. And so over the years, over the generations of scientists, these gems have provided us with answers to questions those who planned these plots could not possibly have foreseen. How could they have known, for example, that one day there would be fears of a warming earth, and that plots like these would provide partial answers? Thomas Berry has written that we need a capacity to listen to what the earth is telling us. And that raises the question, will we have, and those who follow us, have places for listening? And that raises the question for the new century. Can we work and can we plan our work already with a distant future in mind? I like the year 2050. That is the year, roughly, when our grandchildren will be the age we are today. Can we look beyond the unpredictable wriggles of a particular moment and think of the longer scales? For as one historian has said, in historical analysis, the long run always wins in the end. So when we look to 2050, the question comes, what trees do we plant now for those generations still not born? A fourth observation. Planting trees is a human enterprise. One biographer wrote that Fairfield is especially interested in trees. Well, that's a gross understatement. He loved his trees. He was passionate about his trees, and he was passionate about his science, as all of us are, because science and research is not a dispassionate enterprise. It was conducted by humans with human foibles and sudden eruptions of vision, of human frailty, and sudden flashes of inspiration. And this humanness shows up so clearly. And this humanness shows up so clearly in those old diaries. There are moments of exhilaration, records of splendid slaying, and there are moments of poignancy and sadness. And the humanness shows up also in the research. There are the timeless frustrations, frustrations of hail obliterating crops, of new engines causing heaps of trouble, of dogs mangling sheep and gophers mangling plots of oats, of human error and a timeless one, the scarcity of funds. There are frustrations galore, but also there are the rewards. And not least among these rewards are the tantalizing hints of elegance and beauty that erupt sometimes spontaneously, unexpectedly in the midst of our work. The sense of wonder, the sense of delight, the sense of mystery that catches us sometimes by surprise. The sense of wonder in the look of the land, in the rhythms of nature, in the grandeur of DNA. E.J. Russell, a long time ago, referring to the biology of farms, wrote, "No one knows much about these things, but if we knew more and could tell it as it deserves to be told, we should have a story that would make the wildest romance of human imagination seem dull by comparison. Well, we do know a little bit more. We do have such a story. Can we find ways to convey the delight, to relish the mysteries, to cherish the beauty? One biologist wrote recently suggesting that we do not need better scientists and technicians, but better poets and prophets. I'm not sure I quite agree, but certainly a bit of poetry in artistry. A bit more of that might not be an altogether unpleasant thing. One last thought. I think maybe the most important. Tree planting is a collaborative venture. None of us can rightly say that is my tree. Only we can say that is our tree. Because tree planting and tree nurturing is something done cooperatively, communally, together across time. Suppose we were to line up all of the people who ever tended and cared for the famous Fairfield poplar. How long would be that line? It would extend way back, almost 100 years, and across the generations into the distant future. And so it is also with the research we do. Take any bit of scientific doggerel, any trivial paper, and line up the people who had a hand in it. That line, too, would extend way back into the past where the ideas germinated and enfold a great congregation of people, each providing their essential contribution to the whole. As our world gets more and more complex, we depend on each other more and more. And so here's the question. Where do we acknowledge each other and honor each other? You know, we take photos of our leaders and we hang them on the walls, and so we should. They merit that acknowledgement. And we take the names of scientists and emblazon them on the front of scientific manuscripts, and so we should. They've earned that recognition. But where do we honor all the essential others who grind the soils and seed the plots and paint the walls and sort the mail, all those other activities which are essential, integral to the work that we do together? I tried to dig out who exactly it was that planted the Fairfield cottonwood. It doesn't say exactly. I suspect it wasn't Fairfield himself. Maybe it was Poland and Schaefer. There's no plaque to honor the planters. But maybe there's no need of one. Maybe the tree itself is a monument to their work. And maybe so it is also with our research efforts. Maybe the fruits of our joint works together are themselves a monument to our work. And when we think of collaboration, of collaborative tree planting, we dare not forget that some of the greatest insights, the deepest contributions, the wisest ideas spring not necessarily always from those who work in labs or those who call themselves scientists. For this is a collaborative exercise involving all of us in the community. Can we find ways to build that synergy, to feed off each other and learn from each other? More than ever, we depend on each other. Across the divides, across the disciplines, for example, between urban and rural. For we are all connected. We share the same lands. We will enter the same future together. So here now I pose this question. Can we ask these vital urgent questions together. We, as a community, what do we want the lands of our grandchildren to look like? And how can we involve these coming generations, those who will one day live there? How can we involve them in envisioning this future? What would happen, do you suppose, if we gave each child that enters school a tree to plant somewhere on the landscape? Or what would happen if we gave each classroom a plot of wheat to tend, to harvest, to grind into flour, to bake into bread? What would happen? Two last closing thoughts as we look into the next century. It's a dangerous thing, a foolish thing, to make predictions. But this much I think is certain. There are changes coming. Profound changes coming. Marion Moore has said, there is much change afoot, and this change is rapid, perhaps more rapid than at any time in human history. We can think of all the changes coming, and we think perhaps first of climate change and global warming, and that certainly is important, but there are others, perhaps others more urgent even, especially when we think of farmlands. For example, there are those who suggest that by the year 2050, the world is going to have to produce almost twice as much food. And these increased demands are coming at a time of converging limitations. The pools of fresh water are quickly evaporating. And there is no more cheap energy available and little new land left to cultivate. How will we face these challenges? What will be our response to this emerging bottleneck? What will be our response? I think I know. I think I know our response. It will be the same attitude that exudes from these old journals, these old notebooks. It will be a spirit of optimism, of hope. It will be the tree planters' hope. We will respond by planting our trees, whatever form they take, thereby renewing, regreening the landscape in ways we cannot even yet foresee. So in closing, let me offer this thought. To all of you who have planted trees that shade us now, I salute you. I honor you. I bow in gratitude before you. And to all of you who stand ready, shovel in hand, I look to you with hope. And I wish you happy planting. Thank you.